The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The Supreme Court hands down an unsettling decision, especially for religious conservatives.
Transgender status, sex orientation wasn't around then. When it said sex, everybody knew it meant biological sex, man and or a woman. And so now what they did is they go, you know, fast forward almost 60 years, and they're changing the statute retroactively.
CHAZ, or CHOP, stakes out territory in central Seattle, and the city's leadership, including its police chief, stand down.
And I just realized it was a moment, an epiphany, that this is a pivotal moment in history. We are going to move in a different direction, and policing will never be the same as it was before.
And more evidence surfaces of government surveillance of the Trump campaign in 2016.
What we do know is that the FBI in late 2016 and early 17 had very good reason to suspect that the document was a forgery or a fraud or a fake.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Please follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. A trio of cases were joined together in a decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court early this week. It will likely be referred simply as Bostock for years to come. At issue was the meaning of the word sex in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Many religious conservatives received the decision with grave disappointment. David Cortman is senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom, who represented one of the petitioners, Harris Funeral Home. Cortman observed that the law passed by Congress nearly 60 years ago had no intention of bringing all modern permutations of sex and gender identity and transgenderism into the statute. Doing so is not the business of the court, he argued. David spoke with my friend and colleague in Cleveland, Bob France, from AM 1420, The Answer.
Tell everybody about your client, Harris Funeral Homes, and what happened in this case, just so they have a backdrop of what the Supreme Court ruled on.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this family has been running this funeral home for about 100 years, ministering to the grieving folks around Michigan in the area where they were. And this gentleman worked for them for about 7 years. They had a great relationship. He was one of their funeral directors, and that's the person who's out front with the grieving families. And one of the ideas is to kind of blend in, right, because it's not about the funeral home, it's about the grieving family. So they had a dress code policy that he agreed to, that men wear dark black suits and women wear dark dresses, and he agreed to abide by that. One day he comes in and says, I'm transitioning to a woman and I'm going to come to work dressing like a woman. And they said, no, we can't have that. You agreed to our dress code. And so his employment ended. He sued based on the EEOC came after him, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a government agency, and the ACLU. And here's where we ended up with the decision yesterday. So that's kind of the background that you can see. Even though this is a Christian business owner, and even though the person agreed to the policy, this is where we ended up yesterday as a result.
So the funeral home, the owner of the funeral home is Tom, and I apologize.
Rust.
Tom, I'm sorry?
Rust.
Tom Rust. Tom Rust, the owner of Harris Funeral Homes, basically said, look, we can't have you as a guy coming in here dressed as a woman and trying to tend to the needs of the grieving families who are trying to say goodbye to their loved one, because you're going to create, whether you believe it or not, you're going to create a very serious distraction here for them. So that's why we have this dress code. And this individual, rather than understanding that, said, too bad, I'm dressing as a woman, and if you fire me, I'm going to file a lawsuit. And that's exactly what they did. The Supreme Court, tell me what the Supreme Court's thinking was here, and as the majority wrote, essentially that this is about reclassifying sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act as being sexual identity or sexual orientation.
Yeah, it's really incredible, because the bottom line is that if there's going to be a change in the law, the legislature has to do it. That's pretty much the way our system works. And so people talk about legislating from the bench, which the court shouldn't be doing, but that's exactly what they did here. The reason was, the way you interpret a law is, at the time it was written here, like you mentioned, in 1964, what did these ordinary words mean? Transgender status, sex orientation wasn't around then, and like it is now. And so when it said sex, everybody knew it meant biological sex, man and or a woman. And so now what they did is they go, you know, fast forward almost 60 years, and they're changing the statute retroactively to what it didn't mean, what no one thought it meant, to say, well, now it has this meaning, and that's certain that something should be left for Congress and not the courts.
Yeah, well, and Justice Alito in his dissent said this: there is only one word for what the court has done today, legislation. The document that the court releases is in the form of a judicial opinion interpreting a statute, but that is deceptive. They are doing it what you just said. They're doing what the Congress should do. The Congress makes the laws. The Congress made the 1964 law, and they did so, as you said, with 1964 understandings of what sex means. So essentially, if what they can do here is rewrite that law from the bench in the Supreme Court, what else can they rewrite? How much unchecked power does this give the judicial branch, which is supposed to interpret law and interpret the Constitution, not rewrite it? How much more damage can they do?
Well, I mean, that's the big worry. So you may be on different sides of the issue, and you may have different opinions. You may celebrate the opinion, you may not. But the point is that, do we want the courts to be able to rewrite what the people's representative have already done? And that's the worry, because Americans have to be able to rely on what the law says, not something that's going to change each time they go to a different court across the country. And I think that's the biggest danger here. If they can rewrite this law that's been in existence for nearly 60 years unquestioned, then anything is open to new judicial interpretation. And that should worry everyone, regardless of your views on this or any other topic.
Only this week, amid an activist presence voicing contempt for government restraints of any kind, a new kind of mini-state of sorts. First, they called themselves CHAZ, the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone in Seattle. Then they updated it to CHOP, the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest. This part of the city is presently not actually a state government enclave, according to their protests. Seattle's Capitol Hill is a kind of a hipster, modestly upscale residential and business district in the heart of the city, which raises all kinds of questions about what this means for business owners and homeowners in the area. My colleague Sebastian Gorka spoke with Stephanie Hamill of the Daily Caller.
Is it true the Daily Caller has sent a team, inserted themselves into the autonomous Capitol Hill region of the United States?
Yes, it was called CHAZ, but now it's just CHOP.
Yeah, why did they make that name change? What do you think's going on there, Steph?
Well, they felt like CHAZ was kind of losing the reason why they were out there. So now they're just calling it, the Capitol Hill Ongoing Protest?
Yes.
CHOP, instead of the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. So a Daily Caller sent out a few reporters and videographers to go get a look to see what was actually going on out there, because you'll hear different versions of what's happening there.
Right.
Some people who support this movement or the occupiers, they say, oh, well, it's just like a street fair, nothing to see here, it's a good cause. And then there's other people that will talk about kind of like the violent, dangerous elements of CHOP. So keep in mind, there is a peaceful aspect of it, but taking over several blocks of a city when it doesn't really belong to you in that sense, that's not peaceful. Think about all the businesses that can't operate right now because these blocks are shut down. What about the ambulance that needs to get through, paramedics, police? And they can't do that now because of CHOP. And I actually, I'll get to what my coworkers have been up to. But I did interview the Washington State GOP chairman yesterday, Caleb Heimlich. And he's just sounding off on Seattle lawmakers, explaining that this is just a complete failure of political leadership. They could take control of the situation pretty fast.
Of course.
But they don't want to. It's obvious that they support what's happening, despite the complaints from the police chief there, despite the complaints from citizens there and the residents and the people who have to deal with what's happening there. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you saw this interview, but former Governor Mike Huckabee was talking about how easily they could shut things down without even using police.
Right. Electricity, the water, the sewage. It's very simple.
Yeah. Water, cell phone towers, shut it down so that they can't do cell service, turn off the electricity. And yeah, there's ways to get around that, but you would probably see the crowd slowly trickle away off to wherever else they would go. So, yeah, this is unheard of, trying to create a state within a state. And it's just kind of like, how is this helpful? How is it helpful? And as I pointed out, the Daily Caller went out there to film what was going on. And they did say that there, you know, were peaceful people there. And it did.
But I don't care. I don't care if there are peaceful people there. You can't take over a part of America and say you're autonomous. That's the definition of an insurrection. You can't do that. It just doesn't matter. That's part of a state. If you want to go to war with a state, you're going to have to go to war with the state. So even if the majority are peaceful, an autonomous zone is a negation of the sovereignty of the state and, of course, of our nation. So that's a kind of red herring. Let's get to another question. These polls, there's a new poll out, Steph. I find most polls irrelevant after 2016. But the idea that Black Lives Matter is more popular than anything else in America, do you buy that?
Well, I think both you and I, we always question polling and who they poll and how many people they survey.
Right.
And so, yeah, the new polling shows that Black Lives Matter has become very popular. According to the polling, 53% of Americans support Black Lives Matter, only 25% oppose it. And then if you dig further, you'll find out that Black Lives Matter is more popular than President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. So you have to wonder. We get it. Like, we all support Black Lives. All lives matter. But Black Lives Matter doesn't really seem to care about Black lives when it doesn't fit their narrative. So they don't talk about the shooting deaths, the black-on-black crime in Chicago. They didn't talk about the minority lives that were lost during the riots. So you have to wonder how serious they are. And if you actually look at some of the other things that they support as a group, it's really like a political movement, and it's more about kind of like democratic socialist policies and a takeover more than anything else.
But don't you think that polling result is simply because people are afraid, because it's not politically correct to say you don't like Black Lives Matter because you'll be canceled or fired? Isn't that the real reason for that result, Steph?
It probably is. If you think about it, there have been people who have been fired from their job for criticizing the Black Lives Matter movement or questioning it, not even criticizing, like questioning the Black Lives Matter movement. You can't even have that conversation. We should be able to have a conversation, especially a group that has so much national attention. You should be able to ask what they represent, what they mean for this nation, what they want.
Coming up.
I was at a march yesterday, and I was looking at the 60,000 people that were there. And I just realized it was a moment, an epiphany, that policing will never be the same as it was before.
The police chief welcomed the new occupiers to Seattle when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best, interviewing CNN's Jake Tapper on State of the Union, spoke wistfully about participating in the march that occupied her city last weekend. She said she'd had an epiphany. Even though some police access to the new autonomous zone appears now to have been granted by the occupiers, it is pretty clear that no services were welcome early on. Michael Medved, my colleague on the Salem editorial board, lives just a few miles from all of this activity. He was the guest of Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago.
Carmen Best, she's allegedly a police chief, and she's the police chief of Seattle. She had this to say on State of the Union, I think, with Tapper over the weekend.
But what I believe, especially after I was at a march yesterday or the day before yesterday with Black Lives Matter, and I was looking at the 60,000 people that were there, signs saying, you know, defund the police, stop police brutality, you know, no qualified immunity. And there were thousands of people carrying those particular signs. And I just realized it was an epiphany that this is a pivotal moment in history. We are going to move in a different direction, and policing will never be the same as it was before.
I can tell you I'm at about 12 miles away right now from what used to be known as the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, where they apparently changed the name to the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest.
Correct. Oh, yes, no, it's CHOPA.
CHOP. Yeah. CHOPA. Except there's struggle about that. I mean, if there isn't any revolutionary regime,
yes,
there's struggle about whether it stands for Capitol Hill Occupied Protest or Capitol Hill Organized Protest. But the CHAZ name, there was an effort yesterday to take down the CHAZ sign about welcome to the Capitol Hill Occupied Autonomous Zone, and there was a struggle over that.
Well,
nobody called the cops.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll tell you what, that's actually encouraging. They're starting to focus on marginal issues just like Congress does. So maybe there's hope for them yet.
On marginal issues from the beginning. Look, the terrible, terrible thing about this, and this goes for Chicago as well, it goes for Seattle, it goes for the whole country, is we've had very, very few unequivocal successes in terms of government policy in the United States over the last 50 years. One unequivocal success in governmental policy was what people call broken windows policing, which is based on the studies of James Q. Wilson, who was a professor at UCLA and later at Harvard, who said, look, it's really, really important to get police to enforce things like laws against sleeping on the street, to get police to enforce things against graffiti and against broken windows and against trash. Because when that happens to a neighborhood, it sends a message to bad guys that there's no authority here. And what is very scary to me is I know a lot of cops out here, and the demoralization is terrible. And I think the same thing is true in Chicago, what I understand.
Oh, it's bad.
And across the country. And when you have cops who are discouraged and demoralized and people leaving the force and people feeling rightly totally unappreciated for the effort and the sacrifice they make every single day.
For those of us who don't live in Seattle, tell us about that 6-block area that CHAZ, now CHOPA, has occupied.
Okay, you know, this is what really, again, the media are terrible, just terrible, all of them, because nobody brings out the fact what Capitol Hill is known for. When you say Capitol Hill out here, mm-hmm. It's a gay neighborhood, okay? It is. There are very, very few minority residents in Capitol Hill. It is an upscale gay neighborhood that is known for that. It's the center every year when they have a pride parade. It's considered the center of one of America's most gay-friendly cities.
They erected a border wall, and so maybe Trump will support border wall funding for CHAZ. and also they believe in the need to have weapons in order to provide order within the corporate boundaries of CHAZ. So those are encouraging signs to a fledgling nation.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's not so well enforced. We have a dear friend who is an NRA instructor.
Yeah.
And he's also a former Marine officer, and he's also a professional opera singer, okay? He went up there to see for himself. He found it not difficult at all to go, just walk right in. There are no borders in the CHOP or CHAZ or the Capitol Hill area at all. And what there is a great congregation of homeless people, a great congregation of camps and on sidewalks, boarded up businesses, graffiti everywhere, trash everywhere.
John Solomon is a columnist, an investigative journalist in Washington, D.C. He was particularly visible during the Trump impeachment proceedings earlier this year. Recently, Solomon has unearthed some information into what's been referred to as the Black Ledger, one of the key documents used against members of the Trump campaign in 2016. John was a recent guest of Sebastian Gorka.
Talk to us about this latest finding. One of the key things in besmirching the president, in saying that there was some kind of collusion, was the black ledger. John That's Solomon, right. What is the black ledger, and what is the latest status of the black ledger?
Yeah. So that was a document that mysteriously appeared in Ukraine in the summer of 2016, and it alleged that Paul Manafort took cash payments from a Russian-backed political group in Ukraine, and it led to his resignation from the Trump campaign. And it was one of the two documents, the other being the Steele dossier, that really gave genesis to the entire Russia collusion narrative and the Mueller investigation. Well, I've been doing a lot of work on the black ledger, and what we're learning is that very early on, Special Counsel Mueller and the FBI learned that that document was likely not authentic. I think over the next couple of weeks, we're going to learn some very damning evidence about what the FBI knew and what Mueller knew that he failed to tell the American public about the black ledger. It looks like another dirty trick.
And you're telling us that these things could point back potentially to the former director of the FBI, James Comey?
Well, I don't know who made it. Listen, I don't want to. What we do know is that the FBI in late 2016 and early 17 had very good reason to suspect that the document was a forgery or a fraud or a fake. Certainly by the time Robert Mueller got involved, he determined it was a fake, and I'm going to be able to report on how he learned that and from whom. It's a very interesting story about how he learned about it. But what's also important, this ties into impeachment. Where was that document found? It was found in Ukraine, the place where President Trump has asked for an investigation into efforts to tamper with the 2016 election. So let's think about if someone in Ukraine created a fake document to cause the resignation of Paul Manafort from the campaign and trouble to cause this sort of Russia collusion narrative, there's a lot of good reason for President Trump and all Americans to wonder who did this in Ukraine, why did they do it. That answer has not been gotten to the bottom of, and I think when this new evidence comes out, it should lead to some new investigation. Hopefully the Republicans in the Senate will get to the bottom of this, but there's another dirty trick that looks like it was played on the American public and on the Trump campaign.
Who'd profit from forging the black ledger?
Well, certainly anyone trying to defeat Donald Trump, which would include Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. And as we know, the Democrats had a big effort underway trying to find dirt on Manafort in the spring and summer of 16. What we need to find out is whether that effort and this document are connected, and that's going to require more investigation.
Coming up.
There are generally warnings when you have people who are, you know, pathological like he is. And the possibility of people moving from one jurisdiction to another after they're found to have violated, certain standards. That's not acceptable.
HUD Secretary Ben Carson, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Ben Carson is a retired neurosurgeon who ran for president in 2016. Since March of 2017, he's been serving as the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development for the nation. He's a modest man, but he is quietly confident about his accomplishments as HUD Secretary. I invited him on my radio show to talk about another subject, the murder of George Floyd. He joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. You and I are not going to serve on the jury for the policeman in Minneapolis, so we can have an opinion. In your opinion, was George Floyd murdered?
Yes.
What leads you to that opinion?
We don't have to guess about his case. We saw the murder taking place in front of our eyes. It was captured on video. And you have a man who has already been subdued, is in handcuffs, is under control, and then you're performing a maneuver that can take his life blatantly, knowing that people are watching and not caring.
And so Al Sharpton asked in the eulogy of George Floyd, how does such a person get into the police force of America who can keep his knee on the neck of someone for 8 minutes and 46 seconds? I ask you that question. How does that happen?
because this is a man who already had multiple infractions and has been allowed to remain on the police force. And I think that, you know, there are generally warnings when you have people who are, you know, pathological like he is. And, you know, we have to have some kind of responsibility. And I think, you know, when we're calling for reformation of police forces, that's the kind of thing that really needs to be looked at. And the possibility of people moving from one jurisdiction to another after they're found to have violated, you know, certain standards, that's not acceptable.
Dr. Carson, have you discussed George Floyd with President Trump?
Oh, very much so.
So the president believe George Floyd was murdered?
Yes.
Do you encourage him to say that publicly?
You know, the president is an individual like all the rest of us. And, you know, he has expressed, as you probably know, what he feels about that case when he was down for the Nassau lunch.
Yeah, but not many people saw that. Do you think it would be helpful for him to repeat that message? Because I actually think less than 1% of America knows about the Nassau launch speech. It's actually not NASA. It was, you know, it's Elon Musk's deal, SpaceX.
Right. Or, you know, people could rebroadcast it. I mean, you know, the president, you know, obviously has a lot of different things on his mind. And we all have our opinions about what he should say and how he should say and when he should say it, and what he should do. That probably is not useful.
Now, you're in the cabinet, Dr. Carson, and you know a lot of people in the administration, and you've been involved in politics since 2015. I started earlier, actually. Have you met anyone in the Trump administration who is a racist?
I have not met anyone who's a racist at all. You know, I find real racists are the people who look at me and say, he's black, therefore he has to think this way. And if he doesn't think this way, then he must be an Uncle Tom. He must be a race traitor. He must be this or any horrible thing they can think of. That is very racist.
Well, judging anyone by the color of their skin is by definition racist. And I believe with Dr. King, the solution to that is to have a colorblind society. But now in some circles, which are more radical, they say a colorblind society is itself a racist idea. What do you think of that?
Well, I think Dr. King would probably be horrified if he were here today, seeing exactly the opposite of what his dream was. You know, his dream being people would be judged by their character and not the color of their skin. And we have turned that completely around. And what sense does that make when you stop and think about it? You know, what makes Hugh Hewitt who he is? Not your skin color, not your hair texture. It's your brain. It's the experiences that you've had in your life. That is so much more important than the external manifestations of who you are.
I agree. But I think it's going to be a very challenging season in America. And I look to the churches to lead here. And I don't know that many people do. Do you agree with me on that?
Oh, very much so. I mean, that is at the foundation of our nation, is our faith. And, you know, it's on all of our money, in God we trust. And yet, as we attempt to exclude God from our society, it must be replaced with something else. And that something else does not seem to be very loving and kind.
Coming up.
The only way we're going to get back to giving people full employment, good jobs, is to unleash the entrepreneurs of this country. And there are plenty ready to be unleashed.
Innovation flourishes with freedom. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Matt Ridley is a British journalist, book author, and businessman. Mr. Ridley has a new book, How Innovation Works and Why It Flourishes in Freedom. His timing is wonderful. If the developed world is going to get its economic momentum back, innovation will have to be encouraged. My Salem colleague Dennis Prager invited Matt on his program, this time talking about bringing freedom back to both the UK and the US.
I have told my listeners for some time now that liberty is a value, not a primary human instinct. The primary human instinct is to be taken care of. Liberty is a value. How do you react to that?
That's really interesting. And I think the way I react to it is by saying, does that help explain why it's surprisingly hard to get people worked up about liberty?
That's right.
Certainly these days.
That's right.
People say, well, no, security is more important or something like that. I mean, when you think of the struggles that our ancestors in Western Europe and North America, but also the ancestors of everybody around the world, had to gain freedom, to establish the principle that a person should be allowed to do what they want as long as they don't harm other people, and how that was the great rallying cry of the liberal movement throughout the 18th and 19th centuries and so on. I find it amazing that today, when you say, I think freedom's a good idea, some people say, well, you know, can't be too careful. I'm not sure that's a good idea at all. So it doesn't seem to come completely naturally. I mean, people do, you're right, seem to put security first and freedom second, and they have to learn the benefits of freedom.
Well, so in light of that, I'm curious, because you had a lockdown or have one in the UK as we do in the US. Do you think that 50 or 75 years ago, with the same virus going around, people would have accepted a complete cessation of labor and of even leaving their house as they have now?
I think, actually, we've been through spells like this before, and we came out the other side of them. But it took us quite a long time in this country to say, you know what, now that peace has arrived, we don't need all those restrictions. I mean, the UK kept food rationing going for 8 years after the war. And the argument was that food was still scarce and you wanted to make sure everybody had access to it. But the reason food was scarce was because they were rationing it. I mean, you know, it was a circular argument. And the Germans abandoned food rationing something like 5 years earlier than the UK, and it worked beautifully. So we finally got the message, and then we did it. So, the history of liberty in this country is patchy. We every now and then we give up on it, and we have to rediscover its virtues and its benefits. And there was eventually, in the 1950s, a strong movement to say, can we get rid of all these beadles and bossy boots who tell us what we can and can't do? And we did rediscover our instinctive like of freedom. But you're right that, you know, telling people they have to go inside their own home and stay there, I'm not sure people would have put up with that in many eras in the past.
I don't think Americans would have, you know. In 1969, the flu, called the Hong Kong flu then, killed in America 100,000 people, which would be equivalent today to about 160,000 people. Nothing was stopped, and that was exactly the time of Woodstock, where hundreds of thousands of young people had no social distancing. The whole point was not to be distant from the other person. And what, in your opinion, is different? Why this now and not then?
I think people have been so conditioned to pessimistic prognostications, you know, so the possibility that the world is disastrous and disasters are just around the corner, from the climate stuff to pretty well everything else. We're constantly told the world is coming to an end, that people are prepared to buy a scare more than they would in the past. I think it's amplified by the media, which bad news is the only kind of news that they want to spread. And we've seen in the last few months that it's very easy to scare people. It's not nearly as easy to unscare them. I think you're right that there are people out there who are saying enough is enough, let's get back to normal life. But there aren't as many as I would expect and as I would like to see. The only way we're going to get back to giving people full employment, good jobs, growth and prosperity is to unleash the entrepreneurs of this country. And there are plenty ready to be unleashed. We're not going to get back that way by sort of spending a bit more government money here and there. Yes, we've got to look after people who are in trouble, but we've also got to strip away the red tape, the regulations, the bureaucracy that has prevented entrepreneurs from creating businesses and employing people and starting jobs. That's the message I keep trying to give to our government. I'm not sure it's getting through yet. Boris Johnson's instincts are the right ones, but he's surrounded by an enormous bureaucracy of people who like to do things slowly and do things carefully, and that isn't what we need right now. We need someone who gets the point of liberating and unleashing the animal spirits of the British entrepreneur.
Boris Johnson was opposed to the lockdown at the beginning. His instinct, just like Trump, also, that was his instinct. But what would have happened here, I'm sure would have happened there. Every death would have been called a Johnson death.
That's part of the problem, is that the politicians are taking the blame. And you know, there was a significant scandal in this country, which was very similar to what happened in New York. Which was that a lot of the deaths occurred in hospitals and care homes. And they occurred because the virus got into the care homes and hospitals, and the people in them were not only not given sufficient personal protective equipment, but they were not tested enough. And they were also encouraged to return patients from hospitals to care homes to make room for the expected arrival of sick people with COVID-19. What that did was it seeded the virus into the care homes.
For the complete Prager-Ridley interview, go to www.townhallreview.com. Coming up.
It is clear that this activist thought Winston Churchill is somebody alive today. And I've heard good things. I've heard bad things. I've never personally met the man.
Larry Elder in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, a look at the call to defund the police.
Law enforcement, here's the controversial statement, is the one necessary profession. Every other profession is contingent.
Police departments battle the union over bad cops.
Sometimes they even fire them and they're forced to rehire them.
Dr. Albert Mohler provides a historical perspective.
I want to help Christians connect the dots in our time.
And he looks at a dramatically changed two-party system.
The tipping point was somewhere around 1972 in that election where the two parties just began to absolutely veer off into completely different directions.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The tradition of dedicating statues and buildings to leaders and heroes of the past has been part of Western culture for centuries. During the past 10 or 15 years, American activists have started to oppose this tradition. Today, statues are coming down everywhere, and I agree with many of those demolitions. My colleague Larry Elder looked at this pattern of erasing history in the United Kingdom. Here's Larry.
Across the pond, the movement to erase history through the prism of today's sensibilities is afoot, and there is an effort to remove, believe it or not, the statue of Winston Churchill. So this activist is on a morning show, and she's explaining why she wants his statue removed. And then it becomes painfully clear she doesn't know who Winston Churchill is.
Lorraine Jones, the far-right protesters we saw in Kamey's piece there say that they're guarding Britain's monuments. And Boris Johnson has said that removing statues is lying about our history. Is it?
Well, it was clear to see that they were not guarding Churchill's statue. The thuggery which we all witnessed was horrifying and totally unacceptable. So that was just an excuse for their thuggery. In relation to statues, I think that what needs to happen, which I know has already started, we need to look at the people that are being placed on a high pedestal in this society, the reasons why they are, and honestly and rightfully, if they are supposed to be removed through being heroes of slavery, it's not a good sign. But I know that there's some work going on around that. And the sooner the government can make the decisions to take down the statues, which shouldn't be there, place them in a museum like some people have requested, the better.
Should the statue of Churchill be there or not, do you think?
Should the statue of Churchill be there or not, do you think?
Should the statue of Churchill be there or not, do you think?
Well, I've heard many arguments on both sides. Some say that he's a racist.
Some say that he is a racist, present tense. Maybe that's just how she speaks. You know, it doesn't mean she doesn't know who he is.
Should the statue of Churchill be there or not, do you think?
Well, I've heard many arguments on both sides. Some say that he's a racist. Some say that he's a hero. I haven't personally met him, but what...
I haven't personally met him. What did he die? 1965?
That question of whether he should remain should be put to the community. It's not hard to get that information from the community, because right now we need to have a united and stable society.
And the host said nothing. It is clear that this activist thought Winston Churchill is somebody alive today. And I've heard good things. I've heard bad things. I think we ought to put it to a vote. I've never personally met the man.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.